The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Mr. Flurry is still in Manila. Mrs. Flurry came down with the flu and they can't fly out until she has a doctor's certificate saying that she's over it. So hopefully they'll be back here within the next few days. I've had quite a few pre-recorded programs over the last few weeks, so there's a lot of news to catch up on. So I thought I'd try and do just some of that in today's program, focusing on Europe. Obviously, there's a great deal that's also been happening in the United States with those fires in California, most notably, and then still the aftermath of some of those hurricanes, and maybe we'll talk about some of that later in the week. But to start, I'd like to recap with an article by George Friedman. This is from October 9th, so about a week ago, and it's titled, EU Officials Out of Step with Reality, Europeans Don't See What's Coming at Them. Kind of a long title, but it does a great job of just giving a sense of the crisis and the crises going on in Europe right now. He writes, imagine the following scenario. Texas votes to secede from the United States, sparking bitter tensions between Austin and Washington. A neo-Nazi party wins seats in the Californian legislature. Cook County, home to Chicago, threatens to break away from Illinois to form its own state. Worried about losing such an economically vibrant region, the government officials try to prevent the election from taking place. The federal government vows to suspend North Carolina's voting rights in Congress simply because it doesn't approve of its behavior. It considers doing likewise for Arizona. In such a scenario, you might conclude that something is terribly wrong with the United States. The thing is, this is pretty much what is happening in Europe. He then goes through some of those parallels. The United Kingdom has voted to leave the European Union. The negotiations over its departure are unpleasant, to put it mildly. A party whose members are compared to neo-Nazis has won a surprising number of seats in Germany's parliament. Catalonia, which is home to Barcelona and large and economically vital city in Spain, held an independence referendum October 1st, something the government in Madrid has tried to stop. And the European Commission has threatened to suspend Poland's voting rights over actions taken by the Polish government. It has previously attacked the Hungarian government for similar reasons. Then a bit later on he writes, this is not meant to diminish the problems of the United States, nor is it meant to imply that the problems in the US and the European Union are alike. I simply want to put Europe in perspective. And then he makes another great point just a bit further down about how European leaders do not want to face up to any of these problems. He wrote, but as I discovered last week in Europe, this is not how European officials see the situation. They regard the problems as serious, but not existential. They believe these problems can be managed and point to economic growth in several of its member states as evidence of their management. European officials believe the secession of the second largest economy in Europe can be handled by a reasonable accommodation. The threat to Poland is simply the attempt to rectify a problem there. They think the rise of the racist right from street demonstrators to significant parties is unfortunate, but not symptomatic of any larger issue. The desire of a major part of a constituent member to form a new country is a local problem that will be handled by Madrid. So here Friedman writes about Europe and what's happening over there in the same way that we've been writing about Germany and are writing about Germany in an article for the next print edition for the Trumpet magazine. Germany and then the EU as a whole is in a crisis. In the EU, there's all these points where fires are breaking out, all these major crises. But no leader wants to admit it. I think in many ways, they don't even see it. They're not even willing to acknowledge to themselves the extent of the crises, and definitely crises plural for Europe, and maybe in Germany crisis singular, but they don't want to recognize the extent of the crises they're facing. But if you look at it honestly, Europe is in crisis. Germany is in crisis, but those that will admit that are in the minority. The current leadership doesn't want to change. They want to keep following along with the status quo, business as usual. But that's not going to work. Europe is falling apart. Germany has these major problems. We've talked about some of these crises that Friedman mentioned before. But we'll start by doing a bit of an update. And we'll start with Germany. We were talking a lot about Germany before we had our break, and we were playing some recorded programs. So I'll update you on some of what's been going on there. As expected, Germany does not have a government yet. They're still negotiating. Actually, that's not true. They're not still negotiating. They haven't gotten round really to starting negotiations over coalition talks yet. There are some very basic things that they're only just working to figure out. For example, after several weeks of discussion, Germany's political parties have just worked out where they're going to sit in parliament. Now, it's not a final deal, though. Parliament is meant to open on October 24th, and they need to get an idea of who is going to sit where, which side of the room each political party is going to sit on. So what they've worked out is only really a preliminary deal. Basically, nobody wants to sit next to the Alternative for Deutschland. Nobody wants to be the kind of the next most right-wing party to them. In this particular arrangement, the Free Democrats will be sitting next to them, but they've said that they're going to challenge this and they're going to try and change the way that people are sitting. One politician has called the whole discussion a farce, but basically, these political parties can't even decide on where they are sitting. So great, it's taken nearly a month since the election and we finally got a preliminary deal on who is sitting where in Parliament. That's not a great preview of how smoothly these coalition negotiations are going to go. The main event that these coalition negotiations were waiting for before they kicked off, though, was the state election in Lower Saxony. That was held yesterday. In Lower Saxony, you had another fragile coalition, and that just exposes how these coalitions can break down even once they've formed. The SDP, the main left-wing party in Germany, and the Green Party, they had a narrow majority, which ended when one of the SDP members switched sides and decided to become part of the Conservatives, part of the Christian Democratic Union. So they lost their majority. They had to hold fresh elections. They held those yesterday. And everyone, they decided to delay coalition negotiations until after these elections, because they were deemed so significant. They were going to have a major role on the negotiating power of these parties, on just the authority of the leaders in these parties. Were they showing they could still win elections or not? And Angela Merkel lost that election, coming in second place to the Social Democrats, that main left-wing party. Earlier polls had given her a lead, but then as it got a little bit closer, she fell behind and ultimately didn't win. The local, they were writing ahead of the election, and they were quoting Oskar Niedelmayr from Berlin's Free University. And he said, "A victory in Lower Saxony is important for Merkel because it would strengthen her and show that her party can still win state elections." He then went on to write that a defeat would be a bad sign for the negotiations, which begin in the middle of next week. It was Bild that said that it would be a bad sign for negotiations. So she lost, that further undermines her authority within her own party. So that's going to make coalition negotiations much more tricky. That particular article had a few more quotes from Niedelmayr just on coalition negotiations in general. The local wrote that all players are highly reluctant to make concessions, said Niedelmayr. The FDP, because it has previously wilted in Merkel's shadow. The Greens, because they face their environmentalist base. And the CSU, because it must win Bavarian elections next year. "So I'm still very, very sceptical," said Niedelmayr. "But of course, it is also clear that all sides are under great pressure because the alternatives of minority government or fresh elections are something the German people do not want." We talked for a while on a Trumpet Daily before the break, I think one of the last times I was on here, about just how tricky these coalition negotiations are set to be, how much of a big headache and a major challenge for Germany and for Angela Merkel they're going to be. And that hasn't changed over the break. If anything, it's looking even harder. So Germany's just seems set for paralysis for months and months of coalition talks. Like we talked about before the break, German officials are thinking, well, we're not going to have a government in place even before the end of the year. We'll move on to another crisis point, one also that we discussed ahead of ahead of the break, one that also was brought out by George Friedman, Catalonia. It's another significant development there for Europe. So I think I spoke about that on the Friday before they were going to hold a referendum vote. They held that election on Sunday, on October 1st. And Catalonia, this region of Spain, this pretty much most prosperous and economically vibrant region of Spain, voted to leave Spain, voted overwhelmingly on that referendum on October 1st. The central government had declared the referendum illegal. They tried to stop it by force. So, of course, generally, it was only those who really wanted independence that were the ones that came out and voted. But there was a high, despite that, there was a high, a very high turnout for that election, considering all of the opposition they faced, the violent, in some cases, crackdown from police forces. I think it was about 43% that turned out to vote, and the vast majority, overwhelming majority, voted for independence. As I said, those against independence would have been much more likely to stay at home. Now, initially, the Catalan leaders talked about declaring independence within days. Since then, they've softened a little. They've been making kind of ambiguous statements saying, well, they have the right to independence, but they want to negotiate with the central government. Basically, I think they kind of overplayed their hand in the initial days after the vote, talking about declaring independence. At the end of the day, for Catalonia, I think only roughly half want independence, so probably a majority, but not an overwhelming one. More importantly, the central government have military might, and they're prepared to use it, and the Catalans don't have that kind of military muscle. You know, the Spanish government has an army, Catalonia doesn't, and I think Europe made it very clear that they're willing to look the other way while the Spanish central government does the kind of things that they would normally be very vocal in their opposition for if it was any other type of government. Spain, there's no way they're going to let Catalonia go willingly, and there's not much Catalonia can do to force them. So I think that's why Catalonia is talking more about negotiations now. But there is definitely still the potential for major crisis here. Even with that in mind, you know, if you do have Catalonia or the Spanish government calling the army out to suppress Catalonia, that is still a major crisis for Europe. And that's going to be something that is going to have major implications that just keep echoing on for years. That's something we'll talk about in a minute. But I think Madrid also sees that too, and in the short term at least, that they have the stronger hand, so they're playing hardball. I think in the long run, that's probably not a great tactic, but a lot of politicians don't really think long term. So the central government, they've given Catalonia until today to clarify if they're actually declaring independence or not. Now, there's a lot of emotions. The emotions are running high in Catalonia. The Catalonian leader is in kind of a hard position. He knows logically they're unlikely to gain independence if he declares it, but there's a lot of anger in the streets within Catalonia pushing for independence. We've got a soundbite of some of the protests that have been from some of the protests that have been going on over the last couple of weeks in Catalonia that we'll play for you now. There's emotions really running high on both sides of this issue. One of the somebody high up, I can't remember exactly who it was, but high up in the central leadership in Madrid of Spain said something like, "Well, you've got to remember," talking to the Catalan president and the independence leader, saying, "Well, you have to remember what happened to the last Catalonian leader that tried to make Catalonia independent." And of course, what happened to him was he was executed by General Franco. So that's a not too subtle threat there. So high emotions running on both sides, and even both sides threatening violence. So the central government has given Catalonia until today to clarify if they're actually declaring independence or not. The official response so far from Catalonia has been that Catalonia has won the right to be independent. so not particularly clear whether that's a declaration of independence or not. The Catalonian leader wrote a letter to the central government, I think that was delivered yesterday. And again, it called for negotiations and it ignored the request for clarification. He deliberately left it ambiguous. So now the ball is in the central government's court, really. They're threatening to use Article 155 of the Constitution. This has been called the nuclear option, where it would basically see the central government take over control of the state of Catalonia. They can declare that Catalonia has broken the law in holding this referendum. And then once they've declared that, the government can get rid of the local administration. They can put in a new government. They can take control of the police. They can take control of finances. They can call for a snap election. Politico described what this kind of scenario would look like. They said whatever path to secession the Catalan leader takes, Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy is expected to react to any declaration from Barcelona with one of his own, to invoke Article 155 of the Constitution, which allows all measures necessary to compel a region to meet its obligations to the central government. Although that could take a little while, the upshot will be to worsen an already serious political and constitutional crisis in one of Europe's democratic success stories of the past 40 years. Officials in Madrid claim broad legal latitude to respond to what they consider the Catalan provocation. The Deputy Prime Minister, Soraya Sáenz de Santamaría, said in a radio interview on Monday that Article 155, once authorized by the Spanish Senate, can be interpreted liberally to protect the territorial integrity of the country. So Article 155, it's never been used. The article goes on to talk about it's considered the nuclear option. They said that it would be most likely used to replace the entire Catalan cabinet, take over its powers, dissolve the regional parliament, and call fresh elections in a few months down the line. They quote the leader of the Podemos alliance in Catalonia, who said, "We're facing a situation of total rupture." He said that the situation is the abyss. Another, the editor of a Catalan newspaper, El Periódico, said, "We're facing total chaos. It's a confrontation of a part of the structure of the state against another part of that structure. The only way to take control of Catalonia," he said, "is to take control of the administration." And he's talked about how this could be about the deployment of the army onto the streets of Catalonia. So this is yet another fire burning in Europe. And last time I was on the show, we talked about the potential economic fallout that could come from this. Catalonia is Spain's richest region, and if there's major economic upheaval as a result of this, especially if there is a declaration and if the government starts, you know, cutting off their tax revenues and shutting down their economy while they're shutting down the economy, like 20% of their own economy. Spain is one of those problematic countries. You could see this having major knock-on effects for the euro. But there are other threats to Europe that come from this situation. I've seen quite a few articles over the last couple of weeks saying that that Catalonia shows that Europe as a whole is doomed, that the European Union can never work. And in a way, they've got a point. They're saying, well, if Catalonia and Spain can't get along, who've been one nation for hundreds of years, who speak the same language, etc., well, how can the European Union ever last? And it's a good question. We'll get to that, talk about that towards the end of the program. But this is a situation that really threatens Europe. The Catalonian crisis, it exposes the division that's growing in Europe, the anger that's growing just in all these different regions can threaten to tear Europe apart just as it's tearing Catalonia apart. It also really exposes the hypocrisy of the European Commission and the governing authorities of the EU as a whole. It's a major dent to their credibility. You know, the EU always claims to be this great paragon of human rights and upholding rights and always arguing against any time a government cracks down on protesters. But now look at the situation they're in. The Polish government was elected on a platform of bringing state institutions like the judiciary, like the state TV channel, out of control of the political left. and they're doing exactly what they're elected to do. And the European Commission is screaming blue murder, attempting to strip Poland of its voting rights, talking about cutting them off from access to European Union funds. Yet in Spain, you have a government, you know, I don't want to take sides in the Catalan debate. The European Council of Foreign Relations, they had a great article talking about some of the questionable practices on the part of those in favor of Catalonian independence and how they've kind of ignored procedural rules in the Catalan Parliament, ridden roughshod over the rights of opposition parties to push this through. But all the same, you've got a government that in Spain is ignoring Catalan state law that outlaws the police use of rubber bullets. So they're flouting the rule of law very directly. They're cracking down on their own citizens. There are all these pictures of their pensioners being shot by rubber bullets, people bleeding, things that the European Commission would usually be very heavily criticizing, especially, as I said, when it's violating state law in order to do that. But the European Commission is silent. So you have Poland, a democratic government that follows through on its on its election platform. And to the European Commission, well, that's an abomination because it goes against their own political leanings. But then when a government like Spain breaks its own it breaks the law of one of its states and attacks its own voters, well, that's fine if the nation is Spain and if criticizing them is politically difficult. You've got the European Commission now in its position where it's worse than the boy who cried wolf. Now, it doesn't really just raise the alarm when there's no danger. It then ignores the wolf when it actually turns up. And just like in that fable, the European Commission will find that fewer and fewer people pay attention to it now when it makes these type of pronouncements. It's a major blow to the authority of this central European decision-making body. And that ties in with something. Again, we'll talk about this more towards the end of the show, but we've said for years that ultimately the European Union isn't going to be led from Brussels, but from Berlin. And we see here the authority within Brussels weakening. Now, there's also a much more pernicious threat that's posed to all of Europe and really to all the countries in Europe by what's going on in Catalonia. In Catalonia, we see another stirring of the most destructive force in Europe, nationalism. Nationalism is something that's embedded in international law, that's embedded in the United Nations Charter in terms of the rights of an ethnic group to determine their own destiny. But that has not really been applied to Europe, and by almost universal agreement has not been applied to Europe for 70 years or more. The principle of national self-determination and this idea that an ethnic group can determine their own destiny has been at the core of the 20th century's most violent conflicts. In theory, it sounds great, it sounds fair, but then when applied to Europe after the Treaty of Versailles, after the end of World War I, it was a disaster. Paul Johnson wrote in Modern Times, "Violent ethnic nationalism both dictated the nature of the Versailles settlement and ensured it would not work. It was in Central and Eastern Europe that the violence and racial antagonism which provoked it were most acute, widespread, and protracted. A score or more minor wars were fought there in the years 1919 to 1922. They are poorly recorded in Western histories, but they left terrible scars." And he goes on to write that these scars contributed directly to the chronic instability in Europe between the wars. The Versailles Treaty, in seeking to embody the principles of self-determination, actually created more, not fewer, minorities and much angrier ones. Many were German or Hungarian, armed with far more genuine grievances. Every country was landed with either an anguished grievance or an insuperable internal problem. And this grew into what Fritz Stern and also Paul Johnson called a 30 years war, beginning in 1914, and just basically continuing almost constantly from the point of view of those Central and Eastern European nations until the end of World War II in 1945. This idea that an ethnic group has the right to determine their own destiny just led to a almost disintegration of the states in Western and Eastern Europe, and all of them fighting each other. And so after World War II, self-determination was naturally deemed a poor foundation for not modern Europe. And so instead, Europe just decided, well, these are the borders, and they're not going to be changed except by mutual consent. And it's left many ethnic minorities in other countries, but no one will support their claims for independence or for separation or for joining a different country, because they're afraid of just bringing down the whole situation, the whole, you know, the whole structure on their own heads. But this kind of agreement that borders aren't going to be changed has already come under attack. Germany helped redraw the borders in Yugoslavia, disintegrating that nation. And they did it there for their own political interest, but they, you know, they wanted it happening there. What they didn't want was this spread of this idea of self-determination and ethnic nationalism to spread any further than Yugoslavia. They wanted Yugoslavia to be a one-off, because they benefited in Yugoslavia. But then Russia took the same principle, and they did the same thing in Georgia and in Ukraine. And both locations, when they were changing borders, when they were annexing Crimea, they pointed at Yugoslavia and said, well, we're just doing the same thing that Germany did, that Europe did, backed ultimately by the United States in Yugoslavia. And in quite a lot of ways, they were right. That's what they were doing. Stratfor, I think it was Friedman, but Stratfor at least wrote back in 2015 that Europe's borders have been in flux for some time. That is indeed a matter of concern. Historically, unsettled borders in Europe are precursors to war, as we've seen in Yugoslavia, the Caucasus, and now Ukraine. Precursors to war. And now you're seeing unstable borders, not in one of these nations that's to the fringe of Europe, but Spain. That is, at least metaphorically, right at the heart, and culturally, right at the heart of Europe. And you've got all these other borders that don't make sense across Europe, and really borders where there's no way of drawing them in such a way as they do make good sense. There's a whole lot of Hungarians living in Romania, many of whom would rather be part of Hungary, but there's no clear way of disentangling them. If you chop that area off and gave it to Hungary, well, then it would just be full of areas within there that have lots of Romanians that would want to be part of Romania. The only way to make it work would just be to almost have individual houses or cities deciding which country they're a part of, and you'd have a mess, not a border. You've got ethnic Germans in Poland, ethnic Russians in the Baltic states. You've got the Dutch speakers in Belgium that want to break off from being part of Belgium. You've got parts of Italy that have been talking about independence from the south of Italy. Even Bavaria. There are some in Bavaria that are talking about breaking off from the rest of Germany. And there's no easy way, as I said, of resolving these borders. No clear-cut edits that you could just make to a map to solve the problem. You could carve out chunks of territory to form new states or to pass on to existing states, but then these new states themselves would have more minorities. And ethnic self-determination isn't always the just course of action anyway. The presence of ethnic Russians, large numbers of ethnic Russians in the Baltics, well, that's there largely because the Soviet Union deliberately shipped large numbers of Russians in and shipped large numbers of Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians out to try and give themselves leverage for exactly this kind of situation, thinking down the line that, well, if we've got a lot of Russians there, we stand a better chance of keeping that area that we've conquered as part of Russia. To give that area back to Russia because of the presence of ethnic Russians would, I mean, they're definitely not a majority, but to do anything like that would just be rewarding this kind of very cynical strategy from Russia, and what is ultimately ethnic cleansing from Russia. And then when you look at population movements, well, then it gets even more convoluted and confusing. Well, that was exactly the case in Kosovo, this area that was once the heart of Serbia and that was once just, you know, historically a core part of Serbia. And then, but they're no longer a majority. There's other people that have moved in. And so, well, then those other people want independence. And so you've got all kinds of those situations across Europe. In those cases, it's often Germans that were moved out after World War II and others moved in. So changing borders and independence referendums and things like that opens up a whole can of worms in Europe. And that's why these European leaders have all been looking away and have been generally not that keen to support Catalonia. they're looking at their own independence movements or their own large chunks of ethnic minorities in their own countries. The last thing that they want to do is encourage ethnic nationalism. And so in the end, this ethnic nationalism that you see rising all across Europe and in Catalonia, well, that doesn't just threaten the European Union, that threatens many of the nations within the European Union. And so you've got just this longer, much longer term threat that this could spread and cause Catalonia-type problems all across Europe. And then you can imagine the heavy hand that that will require from Europe to put down. Just like the Catalonia crisis is pushing Spain into a more authoritarian and militaristic direction, you could see then as it spreads that pushing all of Europe into a more authoritarian and militaristic direction. Now, these are just two of Europe's latest problems. We'll explore where this is leading towards the end of the second half. But we'll take a quick break. And when I get back, we'll talk about as well a solution to some of these problems that's starting to emerge in Austria.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
The head of Austria's Conservative People's Party, Sebastian Kurz, is on track to become the world's youngest leader. Projections in the country's general election showed the 31-year-old was set to take just over 31% of the vote. But despite jubilant scenes among his supporters, the initial result puts Kurz's party well short of a majority, potentially pushing him into bed with the far right. "We have made the impossible possible," he said. "Thank you for your commitment and for this historic success. It is our task to talk and work with all the others for our country, and it is our task to change the country for the better." As counting continued, the Social Democrats of current Chancellor Christian Kern were battling it out with the far right for second place. Lamenting Austria's lurch to the right, Kern said, "We've seen a massive shift to the right in the country. During the last 24 months here, possibly more, there's been a constant and brutal right-wing political agenda carried out by political parties, but honestly, we cannot exclude the media from this either." For the far right, led by Heinz Christian Strache, it was a memorable night. Delivering one of its strongest performances in an election, his anti-immigration Freedom Party was tipped to take just over a quarter of the vote, putting it in a position to rejoin the government after a 12-year absence. Strache had accused Kurz of stealing his policies after the latter had pledged to shut down migrant routes in the wake of Europe's 2015 refugee crisis.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. In the first half, we were talking about some of the crises that Europe is facing. We read from an article by Friedman talking about just the many crises that are approaching and there are a whole variety, and that the current structure just isn't paying attention to them. Well, what's the solution to all this, or where is this leading? Well, Austria gave us a glimpse of this yesterday. We just heard a clip there outlining the results of the election that they held yesterday. And, I think there's some very interesting takeaways from this election. Now, Austria is being hit by the same political crisis that has just been spreading across Europe. And in many ways, they're on the front lines of that. The party that might be in second place, as far as I understand, before I came on the show, it looked like they were still neck and neck, this particular party, with the main left-wing party. But this party that's neck and neck for second place is a fringe, a right-wing group, often called a far-right-wing group or even neo-Nazi. They were founded by an ex-SS officer. They do have many fairly extreme positions. They want a repeal, or at least at some point they wanted a repeal on a ban of Nazi imagery, for example. They've had leaders that say they think that SS soldiers were honorable. And so this party's been rising. And at the same time, Austria's two main parties have just been collapsing. In 2010, their main left-wing and their main right-wing parties, they received combined 80% of the vote. So 80%, 4 out of 5 Austrian voters voted for one of these two parties, the main left-wing party, the main right-wing party. In the 2016 presidential election, only 20% voted for one of these two main parties. Just a stunning collapse for both of these mainstream parties. They seem dead. Now, at least one of them is coming back. And a lot of that is down to the man you heard about just at the intro to this section, Sebastian Kurz. Kurz is set to, as he heard there, set to be the youngest leader anywhere in the developed world at just 31 years old. And really, it's been a remarkable turnaround for Austria's main right-wing party, the OVP. The Austrian People's Party. Things were looking pretty grim for them. They'd lost a lot of support. They were getting pretty desperate. And they wanted rescuing. And Kurz came along and he laid out conditions. He said, I'm only going to lead this party if you give me what amounted to basically unprecedented control for a party leader over the party. He had certain conditions that effectively put so much more of the party under his personal control. And so they agreed to those conditions. So he agreed to lead them. And so he really was responsible for this big turnaround. As soon as he was in charge, he torpedoed his party's current coalition. The party were a junior coalition to the Social Democrats, the main left-wing party. And he pulled out of that, forcing the nation to hold fresh elections. These were the elections that were just held yesterday. And those are the elections that Kurz won. His party emerged as the biggest party. And how he won is really significant. He won by shifting to the right. He won by promising to crack down on migration. He won by speaking out against Islam. He won by going into it saying that he may well do a deal with the far right. Completely different to in Germany, where the right-wing parties went into it saying, on no conditions will we ever do a deal with the far right. He didn't promise one. He wants to keep his options open so he can kind of play both sides against the other. He could work with either the far right or the main left-wing party. But he went into it saying, we may well work with the far right. He went into it even as you heard in that clip, the leader of the far right party was accusing him of stealing all of their policies. He also won because of just his own personality and charisma. The European magazine, this was just a very quick, rough German translation, they wrote that Sebastian Kurz is something like a Ferrari among politicians. Elegant, eloquent, fast, especially with design. The media, they talked about how they've already started calling him the Danube Messiah. They said, where he appears, the masses tremble. He talked about how he has something of a rock star effect. Now, if this is sounding familiar to regular listeners of the program, it may well do so, because one of the other things that Kurz has been called recently is Austria's Zu Gutenberg. He's been called Austria's Zu Gutenberg. The two, actually, Karl Theodor Zu Gutenberg, the former German defense minister and once again rising political star in Germany. He is friends with Kurt. Someone, apparently the two of them have even considered going into business together, but they're in contact. Kurtz's party is kind of considered the Austrian sister party of the Christian Democratic, Christian Social Union parties in Germany. Those three parties tend to be quite close. Now, Kurz has been much more anti-immigration than Angela Merkel is, and so they're not necessarily really close right now. In fact, Kurz, before this election, he was Austria's foreign minister, and really, I think he deserves a lot of the credit for ending the migrant crisis or reducing the migrant crisis in Europe. A lot of that gets given to Angela Merkel for the deal that she did with Turkey. But I think really more of the credit should go to Kurz. He kind of got all the Balkan nations together and they all agreed to shut their borders that would just leave immigrants stranded in Greece. The conditions for migrants in Greece were pretty terrible, and so fewer of them even stopped wanting to travel to Greece in the first place because they could no longer travel north through the Balkans or through Austria. And he was responsible for that. I'll just read a bit more about him before we talk about just how his victory could impact Germany. Handelsblatt had a piece this is from their daily email briefing. They wrote that Kurz's win is a symptom for Austria's hard right malaise. He and the far right FPÖ leader Heinz Christian Strache each tried to outdo the other in a largely monothematic election campaign where the only real issue was how to fend off refugees. That's where the refugee crisis has pushed Europe. And said, and wouldn't you know it, anti-refugee rhetoric was just what the doctor ordered. That's how you get elected in Europe, anti-refugee rhetoric. Between the two of them, Strache and Kurz raked in a total of plus 14 percentage points. Right is the new center in the 8 million citizen Alpine Republic. Right is the new center. This is a shift that's happening all across Europe. Just another, here's it from another Handelsblatt article. For a nation of just 8 million people, Austria has of late had an outsized impact on Europe and its policies towards refugees. The Alpine country, located at a critical juncture in Central Europe, effectively forced an end to the 2015-2016 refugee crisis by closing its borders in coordination with several Balkan nations. This transformation from one of the most liberal refugee policies towards a hardline stance could be confirmed in Sunday's election and prove a bellwether for all of Europe. The controversial border closures was led by a photogenic foreign minister who was barely 30 years of age at the time, Sebastian Kurz. So now it says this same Kurz is likely to be elected Austria's next chancellor and the youngest leader of the Western world. They talked about it. With his ascendancy, he has rescued the OVP, which hails from the same tradition as Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats, from the doldrums. They talked about how he could go in coalition with the far-right party, and they write that such a coalition government would mark the second time that Austria has been led by a coalition between the right and the far-right. That was really unusual then, but this time, with leaders like Viktor Orban of Hungary and Beata Szydło of Poland, in a much tenser confrontation with Brussels, Austria's transformation is likely to pass more or less unnoticed. Now, Germany, I think, is definitely going to notice, though. They'll be watching you. Austria has been through even worse than what Germany went through in terms of election crises. And Kurz has just shown you the way back for a right-wing party. This is how you deal with it. A young, charismatic politician moving to the right, speaking out against Islam. Speaking out against migration. It's for good reason that Kurz has been called Austria's Zu Gutenberg. Is he showing Germany the way forward? I think he may well be doing that. But then look at the trend that he's a part of, just as we read. You've got these strongman type leaders now in Poland, in Hungary, Slovakia in some ways, now Austria. It's not just necessarily that these further right parties, as you could call them, sometimes called far right, but these parties, it's not just that they're just doing well, they're actually winning. They're becoming parts of government in unprecedented ways. So we're seeing this great change in Europe and in European politics. So we're seeing it now coming to Austria. And then you go back and you look at all the crises that we talked about in the first half, with Europe in a crisis. Austria's elections now is another rejection of the values of the European Commission and the EU's elite. You've got, you said, Catalonia, Germany leaderless. You've got just the euro crisis still rolling on. This is why Europe in its current form cannot last. It's beset by all of these crises that are going to soon change it. Back in 2008, December 2008, in the midst of the financial crisis, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote that these crises would force Europeans to succumb to a strong united government of Europe, led ultimately not from Brussels, but from Berlin. He wrote, this is again 2008, the crisis in Greece is a forerunner of a whole rash of similar crises set to soon break out across Europe. Haven't we seen exactly that? And that's just a history of the last 8 years of Europe, a rash of similar crises. He wrote that they will prove the catalyst for the EU's leading nation, Germany, to rise to the fore with solutions of its own making. And haven't we seen that since 2008, 2009? Germany really rising. You know, before 2008, it was just about only the trumpet saying, well, the heart of Europe is Germany. Germany really leads Europe. Since then, I've seen it where we've just got pages and pages of bullet-pointed lists of headlines talking about things like a new Fourth Reich, how Germany leads Europe. Exactly what we've already seen. It's still ongoing. The process is still rolling out, but this is exactly what we've seen happen. Mr. Flurry went on to write, Bible prophecy declares that the result will be a European superstate with Germany at the helm. That's where it's leading. We'll just look at some prophecies that are behind what Mr. Flurry is saying here, where he gets this from. And one of the core prophecies that he's using to make those forecasts that have already been proven so right is Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17 shows a vision. It says in verse 3, it talks about an angel carrying John away into the wilderness. And he says, I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. So we'll look at this beast first. There's this beast, and you can see in Daniel chapter 7 where beasts are used as symbols for empires. And that's confirmed just even within this own chapter, chapter 9, where it starts to explain it. It says the seven heads are seven mountains. And again, in biblical language, a mountain is a symbol for a nation or a kingdom. You can see that in Isaiah chapter 2. So further confirmation of this description. Seven heads, seven kingdoms, seven empires. You see this also in verse 10, and there are seven kings. So direct confirmation here that this is talking about seven different kingdoms. And if you read, it says five are fallen, one is, the other is not yet come. So these seven kingdoms, these each occur successively, one after the other. They're not seven kings that rule at the same time. Instead, one follows on from the other. So you've got seven empires that follow on, one from the other. Now you'll remember that this beast, it had seven heads, but it also had, and that's what the seven heads are, these seven kingdoms, they also have 10 horns. And again, the Bible explains that. And these 10 horns, which you saw, are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. They have one mind and shall give power and strength unto the beast. So these 10 kings are not successive. These 10 kings all rule at the same time together. So you have, putting this all together, and it says that these are not yet come. It also in verse 10 tells you that the very last head is not yet come. So you have an empire that rises and falls. It rises and falls a total of seven times. And in that very last rise, it's led by 10 kings that rule together. Now, at the beginning of it also discusses a woman that's sitting upon them. In verse 1, she's called a great whore that sits upon many waters, whom the inhabitants of the earth, verse 2, have committed fornication with. So this woman then, the Bible generally in the church, in Bible symbolism, a woman is generally representative of a church. You can see that in 2 Corinthians 11 or Ephesians 5. It talks about how This woman is arrayed with scarlet and colour and decked with precious gold. You know, she's conspicuously wealthy. She rules with the kings of the earth. She has great political power. Verse 18 says that this woman is a great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So it's a religion that's centered in a city that enmeshes itself with the affairs of the kings of the earth. It's a major power player. So this is an empire constantly resurrected that's ruled by a church. It's the constantly resurrected Holy Roman Empire in Europe, this idea where you keep having leaders that want to resurrect the Empire of Rome. And every time they do it, they have an alliance with a church. You saw this with Emperor Justinian reunifying back with Rome. You saw this with Charlemagne. You saw this with the Holy Roman Empire. You see this with the Habsburg Empire. You saw this with Napoleon even trying to do this, proclaiming himself as Caesar of Rome, saying, well, I've resurrected Rome, and trying to form that same relationship with the same church. So this is exactly what's prophesied. And these prophecies say, well, right at the end of that, there will be 10 kings that will rule together. Daniel chapter 2 discusses this as well, and it gives some added detail. Daniel chapter 2 doesn't talk in terms of beasts. It describes a great statue. And it describes an image, and it goes through, again, successively. At the top of the image is the oldest kingdom. Then as you go down, you get another kingdom that succeeds it. And at the very bottom are 10 toes. So just like the last head of the beast of Revelation has 10 horns, the very end of this image in Daniel 2 has 10 toes. There are 10 nations. And it says, as you saw, the feet and the toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, for there shall be in it the strength of iron. But as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. So that's what's coming in Europe, these 10 kings, but it's partly strong and partly broken. It will be fracturous. It won't get along. That's why those that look at Catalonia and say, well, Europe is doomed and it's never going to work, that's why in many ways they're right. It's not going to be this perfect, harmonious union. But notice the ultimate fate of these 10 toes. Daniel 2 and verse 44 says, in the days of these 10 kings, well, these kings, meaning these 10 kings, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms and stand forever and ever. So the Bible foretold exactly these conditions in Europe. We've been forecasting these crises in Europe because of these prophecies. We've been saying, well, look, the Bible says there are going to be 10 kings. Right now, there are 27 nations in Europe. They've got to get whittled down to 10 kings. Well, that implies a lot of crisis. That implies a certain amount of upheaval. And so you're going to have 10 strong men. And you see now how these crises and upheavals are causing strong men to come up in Europe, in men like Viktor Orban in Poland, in Kurz in Austria, these other people in Poland. And maybe these leaders that we're seeing right now, maybe they will become some of these 10 kings. Maybe that's what we're seeing in response to these strong men right now. But this is why we've been saying there'll be all these crises. And this is where this crisis is leading, to these strong men, but also 10 strong men, not 27. So big changes for Europe. And led, you can put together from other prophecies from Germany. Mr. Flurry, in the Daniel and Locke's Revelation booklet, writes, it's truly astounding what God reveals through this image. It shows us the history and prophecy from the time of Nebuchadnezzar all the way to the end. You can follow the image down through the centuries, to the legs, then the feet, then the toes. Then Jesus Christ returns. That's what it's talking about in Daniel 2 and verse 44, the God of heaven setting up a kingdom. He writes, if you follow that image from head to the toes in faith, then you know Jesus Christ is about to return. Prophecy shows that we're about to see the 10 toes. And when we keep this whole picture in mind, we know that this world and this phase of God's plan is about over. He writes that we see how it all ends. We're living in the time of the toes, and the stone that shatters them is about to fill the whole earth. Jesus Christ is going to smash the great image, break it in pieces. Then the image becomes as chaff left from the wheat that's blown away. Everything not part of God's family has this deplorable end. It's about the establishing the God family on this earth. So that's what's coming. That's when you look at Europe and you see Europe whittle down towards 10 toes, as you watch that happen, as you will be able to do over the coming months, you can then, you can know that all of this was forecast and know that it's leading to the God of heaven setting up this kingdom. It's going to be a pretty dark, unpleasant process watching and world, watching this rise of this European power with these 10 kings, these 10 strong men. But as you watch that, you can know that the Bible forecast that millennia ago. And you can know that what the Bible forecast beyond that is sure, that these kings will last only for a short time. And then the God of heaven is going to set up his kingdom, which will never be destroyed. That's where this is leading. Now, you can read more about this in our free booklets or free books, The Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy, and Who or What is the Prophetic Beast. It will go through these prophecies, break them down in detail, and prove them to you. You can also look on the trends page of our website to get the background for those. All of our booklets are free. You can get them on our website. We're more than happy to ship them out to you anywhere in the world so that you can learn about the hope behind the crises and the dark events that are going on in Europe right now. That's about it for me today. Remember to keep emailing us at td@kpcg.fm and tune in tomorrow. I doubt Mr. Flowery will be back. We've got either myself or Mr. Andrew Loker might be covering, and we'll hopefully have Mr. Stephen Flowery back with you as soon as possible.